to another episode of Wisdom Chat. I'm Phil Holdsworth, your host from Aurum Gold, and my guest today is Jackie Collier. Welcome, Jackie.
Hi there.
We're going to be talking all things sort of housing. And Jackie, just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the work that you and your husband do.
So I'm Jackie Collier. We're based in Keighley in West Yorkshire. We work largely around Keighley and Bradford area. So our main method of operandi, should I say, is to buy houses, usually that need work to do them up. And then we either put them out for private rental or for social housing. So at the moment, or the housing market in the past has been buoyant beyond belief out of COVID, whereas now we're plateauing a bit. So so the aim is to get as many houses as we can, largely to social housing, because there are just not enough houses and too many people needing them.
Well, that leads me then, Jackie, into my first question, really, I suppose, and that is there a housing problem in the UK?
There is definitely a rental housing problem in the UK. The purchase of houses is definitely slowing down. People couldn't get houses because prices were going through the roof after COVID. Everybody wanted to move, and the housing market was buoyant beyond belief. But with increased mortgage rates and cost of living crisis, generally the available stock of houses is a lot less than it was. And the number of people wanting to buy them is a lot less. So that side of the market has plateaued. However, the number of people wanting to rent is going through the roof, partly because it's always been massive demand. But now it's because people who perhaps were looking to buy can't afford to buy with the increased costs that they're now having to rent as well. On top of that, you've got social housing dilemma. There are a huge number of people that are classed as homeless in some form, and homeless doesn't necessarily mean sleeping on the streets. It could be people sofa surfing. It can be people in temporary accommodation. And there's something like one in every 170 people in the UK falls into that category, which is a frightening, frightening figure. So the need for both private rental and for social housing at the moment is huge, but there are a lot of barriers, shall we say, to be able to easing that situation.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, for the sake of our listeners, just explain a little bit about what you mean by social housing.
So social housing kind of covers three different levels. So the most normal, most straightforward is people that are on housing benefit, universal credit. So they might still have a job, but they get a top up, or they get universal credit to help them get a house through private rental. The next level are people who need accommodation and are helped by housing associations or charities. And this is usually people who have suffered some kind of situation that it makes it more difficult for them to actually go it alone. So they might be a victim of domestic abuse. They might have a financial crisis where they've lost their job and they can no longer afford to maintain the lifestyle they had before or to afford property. They might be the homeless, as we think of it, as people on the streets, ex-veterans, they come out of the services. There's a whole wide range of people that classed as social housing that need help through social housing associations. And then the highest level is supported living, where it's usually people who have got either physical or learning disability that need additional help through care providers who maybe do more than just visit on a weekly basis. They might be living or whatever, or they might need certain aspects within the home, like wheelchair access, certain facilities, soft areas, etc. So that's kind of the top level of what's called social housing. We operate mainly in that middle area, which is working with the housing associations and the charities, to help those people who have fallen on some degree of hard times that mean that they cannot carry on with how they were before and they need help to get them housing.
Yeah, I just wanted to just to clarify that point about social housing, because there's misconceptions as to what is social housing and getting a crossover with council houses and so on. So and a mixture of affordable housing. Affordable housing is not social housing, but it's housing that's been made more affordable for those who want to privately purchase a property. Certainly for those who are just trying to get their foot on the ladder. It's interesting with regards to the level of social housing. I was looking at some figures, and do you know, from 2020, the figure was of those in who occupied social housing, it was about 19.5% of all households. But that dropped off to 16.5% in 2022. So there's been a decline in social housing. Some of that, I would imagine, and again, we just separate out council and social housing, but council, you know, from the days of Margaret Thatcher, they've been wanting to get rid of their responsibility of council houses. So they've been selling them off initially through the scheme where people could, you know, buy their property that they were living in at a vastly reduced price and over a given period of time. But then there was the issues of mortgage lenders, really the mainstream mortgage lenders really not wanting to get involved. So subprime lenders who were involved in that, which meant that people were paying more in terms of interest rates. And back then, the behaviours of subprime lenders where people were had missed their mortgage payments, were shocking. You know, immediate evictions and bailiffs and things like this. And, you know, now a lot has changed in that field today. There's still practices that need to change and need to improve, as we've just seen recently with the cost of living crisis as such and the behaviour of certain organisations, the utilities, for example. So we're seeing those behaviours. They still need to change, but a lot other things have changed. But this leads me to, you know, what are some of the answers? And one of the things you were saying to me earlier about your concern about empty properties. And, you know, we've all seen them, properties just standing idle, you know, and big housing estates being built, not with necessarily all the resources they need, but these properties standing empty and just, you know, derelict. What's your thoughts on that side?
The situation with empty homes or empty houses is huge. Mm. And for me, the easiest way to address it is the councils get involved with some sort of compulsory purchase order. Because if a property has been standing empty for 5 years or more, the person who owns that property is clearly not using it and not doing anything with it. Now, I'm not talking about holiday homes or things like that or properties that are in refurb, or but if they've been empty for 5 years, then that owner has got no intention of doing anything with that property, none whatsoever. It's not even an asset because it's deteriorating and therefore it's losing value whilst it's sitting there. And it's going to end up as a pile of rubble if you leave it long enough. And I really can't see a reason why the councils generally are not more open to encouraging people to take the empty properties on. Now, I understand in some situations it's difficult to find out who owns them. You know, it might be that it's people who have died and there's no probate, they've got no family, whatever. And trying to track back who that owner is really complicated. But that's not a massive part of it. There's all sorts of reasons why properties are standing there. And there are people who want to bring those properties back into use. Yeah. Now, as it stands at the moment, councils say that they cannot favour certain people like ourselves who want to do the property up and hand it over to social housing or private rental because we're seen to get preferential treatment. So they will buy it and then they will put it on an open auction. And that means if they put it on an open auction, anybody can buy it. Now, apparently, they are supposed to have refurbished that property and put it back into use within 12 months. Who's checking? You know, I mean, it's fine having rules, but if you've got nobody to check, then rules get flaunted. So, you know, and people will look, particularly where we are up in the north, you know, people down in London will look and say, I could buy a property for 50 grand. And not really know what they're buying or anything about it. Whereas we know the area, we know what's needed, we know what to do to that property, we know how to make that a suitable home for somebody that the council are potentially paying huge amounts of money for them to be in temporary accommodation. So, for example, if we have a house, let's take a two-bed house. We all get probably £500 a month rent on a two-bed house. Councils have got people in temporary accommodation and they're paying maybe £100 a night for that. So a family in one room with no facilities, cramped together, which is atrocious for their mental health to start with and their physical health. Yet the council are parting with £700 a week when they could, if they work with us, pay £500 a month. Where's the logic?
It's I just don't get it. Just picking your point up there, Jackie. I mean, in terms of there isn't any logic. When you actually think about it and you look at the bigger picture, you think there's no logic in this. It doesn't make sense. And the reason why that you alluded to where we haven't to be seen showing favouritism, I think that is the biggest con our society has to put up with, whether it's local or central government, is this notion we haven't to be seen to be favouring one over another. Instead of doing the right thing, and sometimes doing the right thing is actually supporting an organisation that is actually doing the right thing and meeting a need. And it really does make my blood boil when they use that as an excuse. Let me just say on this, on in terms of, you know, the rules, they create by people who don't understand what it's like for somebody living in those circumstances. They create bureaucracy that ties everything up in red tape to the point where even the well-versed individual has to spend hours and hours and hours working through this to actually do the right thing. And I think something needs to change. Something has to change if we're to address some of the housing issues.
I mean, what I don't understand that how is working with a company to do something like this, how is that different to a company tendering for providing bins to the council or tendering for doing the water for the council or whatever a normal tender for the council is? They then get that work. So in the same way, why as property investors, developers, whatever you want to call us, can we not tender to put a case forward to say, this is what we would do with the empty homes. This is how we would do them up. We've got examples, loads of examples of how we do properties up. I mean, the housing association we work with now, we just handed one over and the guy's come today, sign it off, and he's like, oh, I love the properties you do. I could just move in here with my family myself. It should be. It should be a good, safe, warm, comfortable home for people. So they know what quality we work to. Why can we not put that tender forward to get those houses, do them up, and then put in either vulnerable people on the social housing side, or yes. open up to the private rental scheme, which is also stretched beyond belief for yeah. people who are working. Why should they be discriminated against because they're working?
Yeah.
Why can we not just ease the pressure?
Yeah, it's, you know, on that front, there's a number of things that came up there. With regards to the council and their approach, I'm, you know, don't get me wrong, and for our listeners, you know, I'm no expert in this field, but I observe, like everybody else, the kind of things that go on and the mindsets that are there. And one, it's interesting how very little is investigated. Judgments are just made. People make assumptions. Everybody does. But the other thing is with the council is the focus is on money, because central government are cutting the budgets of local government. So local government are thinking, well, we've got to increase our revenue. What better way to do that than to increase the amount of, say, council tax that comes into the council? Hence, they'll go for the new housing developments, and often in terms of just soaking up some of the green belt in order to do this, there is a big housing need, without a doubt. But there's no necessarily thought in terms of the resources, the facilities, you know, medical, educational, transport systems, road networks, you know, your public transport and things like this. There's no, they say there is, but when you look at what's developed, you're thinking, you haven't really put a lot of thought into, well, how are you going to cater for all these people in this area? And there's nothing, there's no facilities.
On top of that, how long does it take to build a house? Mm. How long does it take to take a field, a green field, and ruin the environment?
Mm.
And dig out footings and lay all the foundations and build the houses. We're not talking quick. We're yeah. talking months, years to do this compared to our average turnaround on refurbing a house is 6 to 12 weeks, depending on how much work needs doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's less impactful on the environment. It's yep. a far quicker turnaround. We're employing trades anyway to do the work. So there's an employment. We're creating houses for people to ease the housing pressure.
Yeah.
Why are they not?
it's logical, isn't it? When you think about it in a factual way and think, you know, what are the needs in the local area? And don't just make assumptions. I'd say to any council, you say you do your surveys and so on, but sometimes, you know, I just wonder as to the extent of those surveys. When you're building a new housing estate in a floodplain, you know, and you're not necessarily improving the local transportation network around it. So I do wonder sometimes, but also making assumptions in terms of what the needs are in your locality instead of really finding out what the needs are and what people are actually facing. You know, when it comes to money, money is one of the least talked about subjects in our society, because we attach shame and guilt and things like that to it. We don't talk about that. It's like a dirty word. You know, it's like you're swearing at me when you're asking me about what's my income. How dare you, type of thing. And you're thinking that's the mentality that we've developed in this nation. And so when it comes to people really struggling with their finances, they won't tell you they're struggling because they're afraid of what you might think and they're afraid of the judgment that people bring. And I know that. I walk around in circles, for example, even in circles where you think people are quite generous, yet I've given presentations about the state of the nation with regards to indebtedness and people in those situations. And I've had somebody come up to me and go, well, it's their fault. They should have managed their money better. And I thought, well, there's an attitude that doesn't help, because they're not asking any questions. They're just making a judgment. And we'll do that in every aspect of society. And we need to stop doing it and start looking at what the real needs are. And you're right, Jackie. I mean, I come from Bradford originally. I originate from Bradford. And I just remember the rows and rows of terraced houses that had just been left abandoned. And all the council did was came and demolished them all and left it as derelict land. And yet build housing association or housing, not association, estates outside of Bradford on the Greenbelt, but still leave this land derelict until some commercial operative came along and bought it up and paid, you know, a swanky fee for it. Because that was the issue. That was the main crux of why they were holding on to the land and not actually saying, do you know what? We've got a real need for housing. Let's take these properties, like you say, keep our impact on the environment low. Let's do these properties up and get people who need to be housed, who are stuck in with families, young kiddies, in a single room, in a hotel somewhere. Like you said, it's costing the council X amount. Get them into this social housing situation at a low cost or low rental and start doing the right thing. I got my soapbox there.
No, but it's true, though, isn't it? I mean, the two things that get in the way of common sense are jobs worth and good old GDPR. Did I say, well, I can't tell you who owns it because it's GDPR.
We basically, through our wanting to deal with issues that have arisen, so we don't like the issue that's arisen, so we make a ruling, a regulation or a law around it, but we do it in isolation to what could be the consequences of making this rule and this law. And they don't stop and think. They never view or seem to look at the unintended consequences. I get it in the finance industry.
The 1%, which is the one that's a problem, but you actually stop the other 99% as well.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just thinking in terms of, you know, the demand, not just, there's a demand on affordable housing. You know, we're perhaps one of few nations where we like to buy our properties if we can. And so we want to encourage that. But we've got this funny notion that, you know, first-time buyers are going to be able to afford a property of 400,000-odd. And you're thinking, which planet are some people living on? You know,
that raises two things with me. Hmm. One, there is the rent-to-buy scheme or whatever. So, I mean, we do what we call a tenant buyer scheme. So you can have somebody paying rent with a view to buying the house in the future. And literally, they commit to buying the house. So they pay the rent, they pay a top up towards what would be their deposit. Hmm. They do that for maybe 5 years. But because generally house prices are going up, I mean, on average, they double every 10 to 12 years. So in that period, the value of the property's risen. So when they come to get a mortgage, what they have paid as their initial deposit, which is obviously much smaller than it would be if they were buying it, and the top up equates to a decent deposit. So they need to get a lower mortgage in 5 years' time. So that's one sort of scheme. But the other thing is as well that, you know, they're putting out these 90, 95% loan to value mortgages. So people will need a very, very little deposit to actually buy a house, which means people are then buying a house. And in reality, they can't really afford it because they're so on the edge, scraping together their 5% deposit, that as soon as the mortgage rate moves or costs go up or whatever, they can't afford what they've basically let themselves in for. So the government have been doing like these government-backed first-time buyer schemes, which in principle sounds like a great idea, getting more people on the housing market. But actually, they're quite risky, really. They might be government-backed, but if the government put that money, if they government-backed social housing mortgages, the market will just open up immensely, because at the moment, which is one of my other issues, lenders are averse to lending when the end tenant is social housing, is part of a housing association or their social housing. So if that tenant is in that situation, then basically we are reduced to maybe three lenders on the market as opposed to the whole of market. And because it's social housing, we get charged a higher mortgage rate.
Yeah.
So obviously that makes it so much more difficult for us to be able to buy the houses in the first place. Whereas if the government backed those mortgages, which actually are pretty much guaranteed because we're on a 5-year guaranteed rent from the housing association, which is backed by the government, then it would make the whole start to finish so much easier. Because the chances of us not paying the mortgage and being repossessed when we've got guaranteed rent and we're doing it for a business, compared to a first-time buyer who has scraped every penny from the back of the sofa to find their 5% deposit, not being able to afford their mortgage, the risk of that compared to what we're doing is 10 times, 20 times.
Mm.
So if you're going to government back mortgages, think about where you're backing and put it into an area that's going to give you the best results overall. Because by us buying more houses and putting in social housing, private rental, and reducing that demand, compared to the number of first-time buyers trying to get on a housing ladder.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't have first-time buyers and they shouldn't get on a housing ladder, and we try and do houses up that we do for first-time buyers as well. But in the scheme of things, you know, if you're going to mitigate your risk, you've got to go down the social housing route and invest in people who are going to repay you and who are going to ease the economy because of the situation, rather than people who are going to potentially in the long term get repossessed because they can't afford the mortgage, mm-hmm. which is stressful for that person who's bought that house. It can, if they go down the whole repossession route, give them horrendous credit going forward, or no credit going forward, let's be blunt, but at least for 6 years minimum. And it just causes then an ongoing situation because the lenders have got, I don't know, 50 grand it costs them to repossess a house or something. So you're just adding a huge amount of cost that could easily be avoided by investing in the right place.
There's a couple of things out to what you said there. One is, in terms of any lender lending, they must do an affordability check. So if they're not doing that, then straight away they're actually breaking the rules. And I think regulators will come down quite heavy on them. So that's one thing. The second thing is, where do legislation and regulations come from, and often come from the government? The government are tasked with, you know, managing the nation and managing our interests. And part of that would be, you know, setting laws and regulations in place so that our society can operate. The problem we have with any government, and so am I apolitical, or I don't know what you would call it. I'm not siding on any one side of the political spectrum. I'm just saying a fact here, and that is governments are in power or in office for 5 years before our next election. And so there's a real short-termism about managing things. And so very often, you can see it every time, main things, education, medical care, whether it's housing or emergency services, they have to play around with these things so they can say, look what we've done. And very often it's short-termism. And they'll say, well, no, it's a long-term plan. We're looking ahead. But no, you want quick wins so that you can say to people, look what we've done. Okay. And that is the problem, because it then doesn't necessarily work for the long term. So some of the things that you've rightly raised, Jackie, I think come about because of those kind of mentalities and that approach. And often, as we've said already, it somehow doesn't make sense, you know, some of the decision-making that's gone ahead. And I see it in terms of the housing around my local area. You know, I see housing being built, whole swathes of housing estates. A, it does take a long time for that to be built, and all the underlying infrastructure that has to be put in place before you can start building the houses. And then once all that's done, then you start to realize you're building all these houses, but what about schools? What about medical centers? You know, what about public transport? And all of a sudden you realize there isn't been a lot of thought put into that side. And I can think of certain areas around where I live that are like that, where public transport is absolutely shocking around them. And they've got no schools, no shops, no medical center nearby, because they're quite rural.
They are supposed to include, when they build anywhere, because there's a community infrastructure levy that the builder pays for the council to provide those facilities.
So, I can think of one housing development in my area that doesn't have any of those. And I don't care what anybody says. I can take them there and show them.
I'm not saying that what you're saying is wrong. I'm saying what they should be paying for.
Yeah.
But taking your point about the affordability, absolutely, lenders should not lend if they haven't got proven affordability. But the problem is people's circumstances, particularly at the moment, change so quickly that affordability at the point they take the mortgage can change really in a very short space of time. And when they've got like a 95% mortgage, that's a huge, huge amount to pay for. And the other problem when you're talking about governments in 5 years, I can't remember the exact number, but the number of housing ministers there have been is astronomical. It's like changing so rapidly. And the trouble is, when you're changing a housing minister, nobody's getting their teeth into it.
Yeah.
They're just getting their teeth into it, and then they're on to defence or whatever the next thing is.
Yeah.
And without that continuity, it's always going to be challenging solving the problem. So
it's almost as if there's more investment in career development at that level, you know, your career politicians, than actually doing a good job. Being in situ, you know, for sufficient time and looking ahead to a decent amount of time, looking ahead and making plans accordingly, and get that consistency. Well, we just don't seem to have that. I'm conscious of time, Jackie, but there's a couple of things I'd really like us, if we may, just to touch on. I just wanted to go back to the point that you raised about mortgage lenders. And I've seen this. I've worked in this environment before, where the mainstream mortgage lenders won't touch, for example, social housing. It's very, very hard. Or if they do, it's much higher cost. Oftentimes it'll be then the sort of subprime lenders that get involved. And I've seen in the past some of the behavior of those. But what really strikes me, and we come back to some of my friends in the industry, an organization, Fair by Design, very often are sort of talking about you know, people being able to engage with the financial market. But also at the same time, the affordability side, we've got the Financial Inclusion Commission that's doing a lot around making sure nobody's left out of the sort of the mainstream. And yet people are. They're pushed out of the mainstream because the mainstream lenders won't get involved because of, I think you alluded to this, the sort of the perception of a higher risk. They just make the assumption. Because you're on a lower income, or, you know, in a certain occupation or whatever, or you're on benefits. That means, well, you mustn't be good with money. So you're a much higher risk, and without any form of investigation. I mean, what are your thoughts with regards to, how do you feel about this mainstream lenders not getting involved? And what do you think they should be doing?
I mean, at the end of the day, lenders' purpose is to lend money to get a return at an interest rate so they make money. That's their existence. So they need to lend money. However, they're very, very risk averse, very risk averse. But actually, I think they're also very blinkered into where that risk is.
Yeah. Let me stop you on that one. Just hold your next thoughts, right? But at that point, I just want to raise this, and that is, you're right. I agree with you in terms of risk averse. They're risk averse in the wrong areas, because if we look back, we're very fickle in being able to look back and learn from past lessons. But we had the whole situation with the crash in 2008, and all of a sudden, you know, it was the regulator saying there needs to be a firewall between the consumer and the commercial, banking, for example. We nearly have banks crashing out of the market and having to be rescued by the government because of the fact that they're risk averse. I don't think so. They just want to make more money. So they'll invest in the areas where high risk elements. And then you get the RBS making choices without doing their due diligence and really making a pig's ear of it, and then paying a fat bonus to their chief executive. By the way, we don't want you here anymore, but here's a massive bonus.
Never have to work again.
Yeah, exactly. And you're thinking, and yet there's people really, really struggling. So sorry for interjecting, but I just wanted to pull up that point about being risk averse. They're not necessarily risk averse. It's just risk averse in the wrong areas.
Exactly. I mean, if anybody wants to look at the 2008 crash, watch a film called The Big Short, because that explains, it's an entertaining film. It's not like a really dry documentary. It is an entertaining film. You've got Margot Robbie in the bath, if that helps. it really helps get your head around how 2008 happened. And one person went to jail who was some minion. Anyway, moving swiftly on from that. So the lenders perceive, as you say, that social housing tenants have less affordability and therefore are a higher risk. However, we're talking about housing associations who are government funded. So the government has a pot of money for dealing with housing for people who are vulnerable, in need, that they spread out amongst the councils, and the councils then give to the housing associations to house the individuals. If you're worried about the affordability or how they deal with money at a tenant level, it's irrelevant. They're not even touching it. They are not even touching the money. So the money that is government-backed, that is coming through this line to the housing association, to the landlord, is guaranteed on a five-year lease. That money is happening whether the property is occupied or not. Why it wouldn't be is another matter. I can't imagine why it wouldn't be. But that money is coming through. Therefore, there is no reason why the landlord cannot pay his mortgage. Now, what you're saying is, actually, in reality, it's not really the vulnerability of the tenant that's causing the issue. You're saying that the landlord may or may not pay their mortgage. Well, that's nothing to do with it being social housing. That's to do with you checking out the person taking the mortgage out and their history, their track record, their affordability, and everything else. And that can apply in private rental as well as it can apply in social housing. If somebody's not going to pay the mortgage, that's the landlord's ethics or makeup, whichever sector they're working in. But actually, in reality, in the private rental sector, they're probably more likely to not pay the mortgage, because if the tenant has lost his job and gets in financial difficulty and cannot pay the rent, the money's not coming in for the landlord to pay the mortgage. Now, I don't mean to say that the landlord don't want to, but it does mean that actually that's the high risk sector, not social housing. Social housing mortgages should be cheaper because they're safer.
And this goes back to a point. Let me say this. I mentioned the likes of Fair by Design and Financial Inclusion Commission and so on that are doing excellent work out there. But it's this issue of what we call the poverty premium and the fact that the poor pay more. And it's the attitude toward them, because what you're describing is it's almost discriminatory toward people on perceivably lower incomes or benefits, and yet they're lesser people and they're more likely to renege on their rent or their mortgage or whatever it is, when in actual fact, there's oftentimes they're more studious because they've got to manage things more tightly.
So they're not even the ones paying it. That's the point. It's even them.
Yeah.
The housing association paying it.
Yeah.
But the same thing is with the insurance companies.
Yeah.
If you've got a social tenant in a house, your insurance is higher because they deem a social tenant is potentially more likely to cause damage or not turn your gas off or whatever it may be, that therefore is more of a risk to the property. I mean, again, if the tenant did cause damage, the housing association sort it out anyway.
That's
part of their lease.
Again, I think it's discriminatory, that attitude, but they're allowed to get away with it because the government allow them to get away with it. That there's not as many restrictions on the insurance market, or they seemingly get away with more than, say, for example, the general sort of lending market. But time's passed us by, but I do want to finish on not just this, but two things, but this one first. And that is, we mentioned this very, very early on prior to recording, and that was this whole thing about people not asking for help. You know, people unable to pay their rent and their mortgage, and they're delaying, you know, talking to the landlords about it, or to the mortgage lender, or delaying saying, I actually need help. What's your thoughts on that, Jackie?
Absolutely. And communication is so important. So we've had a couple of tenants that have struggled with the rent and they've got behind. The ones that talk to us, you can help, you can do something, you can work out a payment plan, or you can work something out because you know what's happening because they're keeping you informed. The ones that put their head in the sand and won't pick up your phone calls, won't answer the door if the letting agent has to go round or any of these things, you don't know what's going on. You don't know why they're not paying, if they ever intend to pay, if they're going to leave, or what's going on. So communication is vital. When it comes to people who own their houses and who are struggling with the mortgage, it's even more vital, because if they get to a point where they can't pay the mortgage and they get into arrears, if they don't talk to people, be it the lender or anybody offering help along the way, if they get to the point of repossession, then their credit is just blown. They will have no credit going forward for the sort of a good number of years. So it means they have to have a pay-as-you-go phone, which costs more. They have to do pay-as-you-go on the utilities, which costs more. They might struggle to rent because the landlord sees that they've got no credit history. So it impacts hugely on their life going forward. So if they can just put their head above the parapet and say, I need help, there are things that we can do to help people. Yeah. So the other thing, sorry, if they get repossessed, the lender will try and sell the house. They will try and sell the house for the best possible price they can get.
Yeah.
If that house is in negative equity, then the difference between what, if the house is, say, if they owe 100,000 on the mortgage and they only get 80,000 for that house, that person is still liable for that 20 grand for the rest of their life until it's paid back. So people forget that. They think that once they're out, they're out. They're not. That debt follows you around forever.
Yeah. So,
but going back, if they actually say, I need help, before it gets to this point, then we can help them. So, yeah, if people can't afford their mortgage, they're probably stressed beyond belief. They probably can't afford the whole cost of living thing. And actually staying in that property probably isn't the right thing for them, because it's going to be a money drain on their financial situation. They really need to do something to be able to move to a cheaper place, be it rented or whatever, where they have affordability. But sometimes they can't sell the house. So what we would do is come along, we would help them by helping them move to somewhere affordable, taking over their mortgage payments and any other costs like council tax and whatever. So as far as they're concerned, that house has gone. It's as good as sold, because we are now picking up all the costs in it. And we have agreed that we will buy it at some point when the value of that house covers the outstanding mortgage, and we'll pay off the mortgage. So they don't have that debt going forward with them. They don't have the stress of trying to meet all these bills until they can sell that house. So it helps them move on and get on with their lives in a much more stress-free environment. But we can't do it unless they ask for help.
Yeah.
Now, if people are on a repossession timescale, it actually shows at the courts if they've got a repossession order coming up or a hearing. So, you know, I've written to people that I know are in that period between getting the first notice and getting to court and said, we can help you. And I get nothing back.
Yeah.
It's got my phone number, it's got my email, it's got my Facebook, it's got everything. Choose a way to communicate with me.
Yeah.
It's confidential. I'm not telling the world what your problem is in terms of affordability, how you got there, because most times it's not through people's own fault. It's just through circumstance that unfortunate happened.
Yeah. Just on that as well, I remember back last year, episode 8 of Wisdom Chat, season 1, episode 8, my good friend Amma Malik and I had a really good chat about this whole issue around people finding it hard to ask for help. So if our listeners are listening to this and they just want to hear some more about why it's so important to ask for help, listen to episode 8. Of Wisdom Chat as well. Jackie, time's passed us by. So one last thing.
It's been lovely. I've enjoyed it.
Well, one last thing I want to do. I mean, some people, no doubt, in listening to this will have found it interesting and may well want to talk to you. Okay. So how best could they get hold of you?
Probably the easiest thing is social media, because it's just everything's got messages on it and such like, so it's probably the easiest thing to remember on something like this. So I'm on Facebook, either me, Jackie Collier, or Jackie Buys Houses, or Airworth Property Solutions. So any of those are my Facebook pages. They've got my face on, so you'll recognize me. Instagram, Jackie Collier Property. LinkedIn, Jackie Collier Property. Jump on, send me a message. If you want to email me, I can give you the email, but sometimes it's a bit more difficult to remember.
Yeah. But by the way, Jackie, and I have to laugh at this. This is an audio going out, not a video. They won't recognise your face, but there we go.
Oh, they won't then.
Never mind.
You'll have to put a picture up.
Yeah. Look, to all our listeners, if you do find this particular episode of interest, it's resonating with you in any way, or you're finding yourself in a difficult situation, then please don't hesitate to reach out and ask for help. If you want to talk to Jackie, then look for Jackie Collier on LinkedIn or Airworth Properties on LinkedIn or any of the social media platforms and reach out to her. If not, you can reach out to me through Aurum Gold Limited. So it's aurumgoldltd.co.uk. And that's Aurum, A-U-R-U-M. It's all one word. So please don't sit and sort of stew in what's going on in your life. Do reach out. And if there are organizations out there, councils, housing associations, investors who are looking to, I suppose, give back in some way, but also at the same time, you know, make their money work for them, then please have a chat with Jackie and Airworth Properties, because you never know, there could be a really good match there. So, Jackie.
Absolutely. And all conversation confidential.
Yes, brilliant. Jackie, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time to come and talk with me about the whole housing in the UK. A lot more going on than we've even been able to touch on here. But I've really enjoyed having a chat with you and catching up with you again as well. I really appreciate
it. Absolutely. That. No, it's been great. Thank you, Phil.
It's a pleasure. You take care. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you. Bye now.